They were saying, are you sleeping? And I remember just lying because I felt like, oh, I think I'm probably a little bit different or special. Like I don't need the sleep or something, you know? So I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm sleeping. So Nick didn't even know that I wasn't sleeping. It was almost like I had this secret that no one knew. I honestly was just like, this is a walk in the park. I am amazing at this. Day 4 or 5 was not needing sleep and thinking I was just the best mum on earth.
Having a baby is meant to be the most joyful time of your life. But for many mums and dads, it can be the hardest and at times the darkest of places. Welcome to Blue Mum Days, the podcast for anyone struggling with parenting.
Today's guest is Hannah Hardy-Jones. Hannah is the founder and CEO of The Kite Programme, a wellbeing app platform that publishes different versions of the Kite app for a variety of clients and causes. Hannah started Kite as a result of her lived experience of bipolar disorder, which was triggered by childbirth in 2013. Her start to motherhood was traumatic, and so she set out to create something for mothers to help support them in their journey, leaving her corporate career in HR. Kite for Mums launched in 2019 and has since expanded into versions for business and to support specific mental health diagnoses, such as eating disorders. So welcome to Blue Mum Days, Hannah. Very good morning to you because you're in New Zealand. It's nighttime here in London. How are you today?
I'm really well, and I'm really excited to talk to you today.
I have a feeling we're going to cover off some business today because, I think we've got a lot in common, and your story is incredible and inspiring that you were able to take something so traumatic and so hard, but actually create something incredibly positive out of that. So take us back, because we must have been pregnant sort of round about the same time. So I had Stanley in 2012 and you had Alice 2013.
Yeah, in July. So pretty close. Yeah. You know what it's like, I guess, being a mum, you sort of still think your baby's a tiny baby and then they just keep, you know, getting older. And so I'm in denial that she's 8, to be honest.
Yeah. So what was life like for you before you started your family?
So I was very much a career-driven person. So, you know, I had a big vision board about where I wanted to be, and my goal was to be the GM of HR for Air New Zealand. So, you know, amazing airline, and I had, you know, a Boeing 747 or whatever cut out onto my vision board. So that was kind of, that was me. And so to be honest, you know, we lived in Auckland. We had, you know, really busy social life, and I loved my career. And so before having kids, we sort of talked about the fact that we didn't want our life to change much, and we still wanted to, you know, see our friends a lot, and that our baby would just fit into that. And, you know, it was just that kind of quite naive view of what becoming a parent might be. And I also had planned that I actually only wanted 4 months off my job. So I had planned to, you know, organize childcare, which was just around the corner from my work. So, you know, like we just had a busy, exciting life. And I guess as a side note to that, I had never had any experience of mental health issues, and neither had my husband. So we were also in this kind of blissful, you know, we were really well, healthy people who, you know, but a parenthood was going to be a breeze. That's how we felt.
And how did you feel about the pregnancy? Because I know when I was pregnant, I was buying all these magazines that had everything sort of like you're meant to be glowing and doing all these things. And I literally had bought into the idea of my baby is going to be like soft smelling of lavender. Bath time is going to be such a magical time. Cut to Stanley going like DEFCON 1 at bath time, and it far from it being like the magazine pictures that I'd bought into.
I know. I mean, I had the app. I was obsessed with the app in terms of like how big the baby was, you know, so there's a real focus on that part, you know, rather than when the baby comes, you know. So it was like, oh, you know, she's a grape now, and she's a so there was that part. And
I think I had the same and it was like, you know, the size of kumquat, and and then it's a watermelon, and
so there's that part. And also I was very much, you know, her nursery was perfect. You know, like I remember spending a long time trying to find the perfect mobile for above her cot, and it needed to be made out of felt. And I spent so much time on Etsy. I don't know if you've used Etsy.
Yeah, yet, I know.
Like all this. But like, it was just like, and I don't, and not that I was actually like that so much in our house, you know, in terms of that sort of homemaker, but it was just, you know, that was the nursery was so important, and all her little clothes were hanging up. And so, again, I guess that sort of goes to that, your mind doesn't really think about the baby in there, and the fact that you're probably not going to hang the clothes up on those tiny hangers because you're really sleep deprived. You know, it's just a complete disconnect was how I would describe it, which I'm sure many people can relate to.
I think so many of us listening can totally relate to that. And yeah, I remember the week before I had Stan was the first week of my maternity leave, and he was actually 3 weeks early, so I only had a week to sort of prepare. And I remember that week like washing and ironing all of his baby grays. I think I might have even ironed the muslins, and then that never happened again. In fact, 9 years on, I still iron as rarely as possible.
Yeah. I know. And I suppose the thing is that there is a little bit of you know, I think there was deep down like that anxiety. So, you know, just doing those things does help, doesn't it? Because you're sort of, if you line everything up perfectly, then, you know, that's creating a nice environment for this baby. But I also don't believe that there was anything that I was reading about, this is going to be really hard. Or, you know, going to antenatal classes and being like, yes, the birth might be really hard, but there was nothing to say like, you might really struggle, you know, and start planting those seeds. So I sort of, you know, yeah, I feel quite strongly about the fact that, yeah, often women are not prepared and from an emotional perspective.
I think you're absolutely right, because there was a lot of practical things. And I remember very, very clearly with our NCT class over here, they had like three nappies, and one was smeared with pesto, one was smeared with Marmite, I think, and another was like yellow mustard. And it was like baby poo comes in all of these colours. I remember that, but there was no, I think there might have been a mention of PND once, but it was kind of seen as, it was very othering when they talked about it. Yeah. It was, yeah, almost like just a dreaded disease that you probably won't get. But if you do, there will be help. But there wasn't.
Yeah, exactly. And baby poo, you can Google that pretty quickly. Like, my baby's poo is highlighted yellow. What does this mean? Like, you don't need to know. You don't need to sit in a class to learn that, do you? I think, you know, 70 years ago, maybe.
Yeah. So how was the pregnancy for you?
So I vomited probably 4 times a day for the whole time, pretty much. So I had pretty bad morning sickness. But I still think I was, I became really, I'm sure lots of people who've had morning sickness can relate, but, you know, you become so efficient at vomiting. It's sort of just like, you know, like, so I just had these little nappy bags and I'd be like, and actually where I was working, they actually had sort of a little, not doctor's surgery, but, you know, sort of a health area. And they had this lovely room that was pitch black with a duvet and a bed. And so my boss let me go and have a nap every day. So I mean, that's super lucky. So I was fine apart from the vomiting. So everything else was pretty good until I got to about 37 weeks and the, you know, regular sort of blood pressure check. And that was when my obstetrician said, look, actually it's really too high and we need to induce you. So everything had been fine to that point.
And so how did you feel about being induced? Were you okay with that?
I felt, because I like to sort of control things, so I think I felt really relieved that I was like, I'm going in at this time and this is what they're going to do and my baby's going to come. I think I did, towards the end of the pregnancy, I really didn't like that feeling of just not knowing and whether Nick would be at work or what, you know, I really didn't like that feeling. So I was actually really happy to be induced, to be honest.
I remember there was famously a lady at our work, her water broke at her leaving day before she went on maternity leave. And it's like, that's bad time.
That's a bad time. Yeah. Especially if it's your first, it's a terrible time.
So you went in. Are you comfortable talking about the birth? Because I don't, don't want to trigger anything.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, comfortable. So I went in at sort of 5 o'clock at night, and they started the induction process, and Nick went home, and they sort of said, look, you know, in the morning, hopefully things will start, which it did. I sort of woke up and my waters broke, and that was pretty much as Nick came in the door. So it was, you know, it was, yeah, I've got like really nice sort of memories of that bit of being like, right, now you need to walk down to the birthing suite. And, you know, we were kind of laughing about, you know, having to stop and, you know, and me sort of doubled over it. Yeah. So that part is actually quite a nice memory, I think. You know, it was quite funny, even though it's obviously so painful. So that was the start of that. And the actual birth was fine. Like for the first sort of hour or two, I actually felt like quite, I don't know, I'm so sure some other women can relate to that. You know, at some point in your birth, you do feel that kind of power, like, wow, this is like a really massive thing that I'm doing. And, you know, and gosh, I feel like this, you know, superwoman. And then it started kind of going sort of quite downhill. So my blood pressure was far too high. So they said, look, we need to give you an epidural to control that, which I was fine with, because by that point it was pretty painful. And I actually quite liked the idea that I didn't have to decide that, you know, like I was like, I didn't have to get to the point of being like, I need one. It was like, you know, you need to have this, which unfortunately only worked on half one side. So ooh, that's not ideal. So wow, automatically they're like, oh, I know.
I didn't even that know could that happen. That could happen.
Yeah. So that wasn't ideal, because obviously you can't have more. And so I could obviously feel it a lot, but just one side. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much of it was, you know, what sort of, how much of a reduction in pain it was. I mean, it obviously wasn't as painful as it would have been without it, but so that the blood pressure situation wasn't great. And then kind of as it progressed a bit further, you know, it was okay, the baby's in distress, and you know, this isn't great. So, you know, very quickly you're sort of going from being like, oh, you know, everything's okay, to okay, things might really not be okay. And I think that looking at the doctor's faces, or the nurse's face, or the midwife's face, and looking at Nick's face, it was sort of, their faces were sort of changing to be, you know, frowning and worried. And, you know, I think that then becomes quite surreal. I think that that situation where you feel like everybody knows something that you might not, you know. I think that's, that's the point I got to.
Yeah, because the only thing I can relate to that is, if you're on an aeroplane and the stewardesses look worried, you start thinking, I don't like this.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there was a lack of communication to you as to what was going on.
Yeah, I did feel like that, actually. I think at that point, they're just focused on getting your baby out. You know, I think that's the thing. So yeah, I don't feel like there's a lot of communication, but I also feel like I was quite in so much pain. And actually, I'd started vomiting by this point. So again, and I was thinking, what's going on? It's a hormonal thing. But so I was sort of quite focused on the vomiting part. And then, you know, it's all quite sort of chaotic, isn't it, at that point? And then I just remember getting to a point where they were like, you know, she's nearly out. And then it was, okay, we need to get her out right now. She's, you know, facing the wrong way, she's in distress. So that at that point, you know, there's the emergency buttons and so everything's all happening. And you know, even at that point, like I even remember Nick holding my hand really tightly and then kind of not having enough strength to hold my hand. You know, he's so worried, it's like almost I can't even sort of give that, which, you know, is quite a that sort of really sticks in my mind, I think, that feeling. So at that point it was, okay, we need forceps. And my strongest, most vivid memory was that there was a junior doctor who was, sort of observing. So his job was to go and get the forceps, because there weren't any in this room, and then he had to go into another room. And as he was coming in the room, he opened the forceps and dropped them. And all I could hear was just like this clanging, like the heavy, it just sounded like this humongous instrument. And so we had to go get another one. And so that kind of put the fear in me too, because it was like, I don't want something that sounded that loud clanging on the floor going, you know, inside me. So yeah, that wasn't ideal. And then she was very much stuck. So it was, you know, it just sort of felt like, I suppose, just that being pulled apart, really. You know, it was like they've got to get her out. And I kind of knew that. And I think it turns out this wasn't actually true, but my memory at the time and straight afterwards was that the obstetrician had her foot up on the bed as she was pulling. And, you know, subsequently I did talk to her and that wasn't actually the truth, but I think that was probably what it felt like.
That was your perception, which
that was my perception. And I think I felt like, because I could kind of see her pulling, I kind of felt like that's how hard she was pulling. She must have had her foot there, you know. So anyway, Alice came out and she was fine straight away. And then very quickly, all I remember was just again the emergency button going again. And they just took her, you know, cut the cord and just threw her into Nick's arms, you know, like completely, like just completely straight, you know, and just, they just said, hold her, wrap that around her, because, you know, Hannah's hemorrhaging sort of thing. So that was kind of like looking at him, like didn't even get her on me, you know, there was no like sort of time to kind of be like, I've just birthed this beautiful little baby. So I lost a lot of blood and then was, I guess, in shock, probably like body shock for probably 2 hours. So I couldn't stop shaking. So I couldn't hold her because like I was sort of, you know, it was almost like convulsing, I suppose, but it was shock. And so for that whole period of time, I didn't get that feeling of her on me or being able to hold her. So Nick kind of would just had her lying next to me and I sort of, you know, but so that was for quite a long period of time, really. So, you know, the whole situation had gone from being quite calm and in control to completely and utterly out of control. Yeah.
You're speaking about it so bravely and eloquently. Just something you said just then actually brought a flashback to me of my birth experience, in that I remember shaking uncontrollably, and I think that must have been body shock because I was convulsing. Yeah. They didn't believe I was in labor, so they induced me even though I'd been having contractions. They didn't believe me, and so they left us and we're going to come back 6 hours later to see if I dilated. And I was pushing, but I remember my body shaking. And I think that's obviously what I was going through as well. That must have been very, very hard for you because you didn't get that skin-to-skin contact that we're told is so crucial in the early moments of having your baby.
Yeah, and I think that it wasn't for quite a few months that I reflected back on that fact. So at the time, I wasn't... I don't think I really thought about it. I think I was just so grateful that she hadn't died and I hadn't died. You know, like it was just like, we survived. But I think that that did really affect me looking back, that I didn't get to have that time.
Does your partner, Nick, did he talk to you about how that experience was for him? Because that must have also been very traumatic for him.
Yeah, he was very much in shock. He said that he couldn't kind of get the image out of his head, you know, a lot of the images of the different things. And actually, funnily enough, the forceps situation sticks in his mind too. Like he said it made him feel really sick, like, what is that, you know? But I think too then, because I became so unwell pretty quickly mentally, the focus on Nick, there was no focus on Nick. And I look back and I'm like, someone needed to give him some therapy or some support. But it was just like, it was, no one was thinking about Nick. They were just thinking about keeping me well, you know. So, you know, even eight years on, to be honest, I probably think he would benefit from talking to someone about it.
that's something that has really struck me about since I started the podcast, is realizing how much of an effect this has on the partners, you know, and not just dads, but same-sex partners who are the non-gestational partners, that actually they're also going through a lot of emotions and often, you know, quite traumatic situations as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Did you stay in hospital? Were you kept in then if you'd lost all that blood?
Yeah, so this is the honestly, the it's so odd, but I stayed in overnight in the maternity ward, and they'd said to me, look, you'll probably be here a few days. You've obviously had quite a huge trauma blood wise, but also just, you know, huge tear, and there was a lot of healing to be done. And so I don't know if you have the same in the UK, but we have here kind of like birthing units that also are almost like mini hotels. So you can go there after you've left hospital for a few days, and it's lovely.
No, I don't know as far as, no, I don't think there's anything like that in the UK. That sounds fabulous.
It is fabulous. And it's actually covered by insurance. So if you have a certain level of health insurance, that, you know, a few nights stay is there, and they make you amazing food, and it's wonderful. But obviously it's only, you know, it's kind of such a privileged position to go there. And I think all women should have that opportunity to go to this beautiful hotel, and your partner can stay too. But so I was desperate to go there because all I'd heard about was these amazing smoothies and, you know, these amazing baths. And, you know, it was like, this was this dream, like I was going to get a holiday. So it was like, I don't want to be in hospital because I want to be there. So the first night, and I was definitely sort of in shock, and I got into the room, and obviously Nick couldn't stay for very long, but Alice was right next to me. And my first memory is a midwife coming in and telling me that I shouldn't be on my phone because it can give babies brain damage.
What?
Honestly, so I mean,
what?
I complained about this, you know, down the track, but this was this, you know, she was an older woman, and she said to me, you shouldn't have your phone there. So I was completely like, I needed to keep, you know, obviously I've got to keep my phone away then. So I couldn't message Nick, or I had to get out of bed to get my phone. So, you know, that's a bad start. And I had a really bad start, I guess, just throughout that night, just in terms of just the care. And, you know, someone got me up in the middle of the night to have a shower, because obviously I needed a shower, and just kind of left me in the shower sort of sitting down and said, oh, well, I'll come back soon. And, you know, still bleeding. And I mean, it's like, you sort of feel like you're in some horror movie. And I just remember feeling really teary, but it wasn't too many hours after that I started feeling really good. And in hindsight, obviously that's not a great sign, but I didn't know that. And so by the morning when my obstetrician came in, I was sitting cross-legged on the bed with someone who's had pretty traumatic, you know, vaginal injuries. And she said to me, you're sitting cross-legged. And I was like, yeah, I'm not in any pain really. And so that's probably a first warning sign of what, you know, ended up being a manic episode. But, you know, your brain's actually starting to respond differently, and your ability to feel pain is, you know, reduced. Your pain, you know, almost goes. So I started feeling really good. And so by the morning, she was like, well, you can go to the birthing hotel, you know, like, you're fine, you know. And I mean, she said to me since then, you know, that actually she should have picked that up, but anyway, got to the birthing hotel, and I just started feeling better and better and better, like really amazing. Like I remember getting an app on my phone on day three, which was like a calendar that Nick could have and I could have, and it was going to plan our whole time and, you know, all these things, and starting to think about like, maybe we should sell our house, and, you know,
wow.
Like, yeah, I mean, and Nick's going, okay, calm down. But I think he was just really happy that I wasn't in the depths of despair. Like, I think he's, you know, he was just like looking out for like, oh gosh, you know, she's been through this terrible time, and I'm going to have to start sort of, you know, watching out for the baby blues, and then, you know, maybe worse. But there was none of that. It was, you know, and I started, and I didn't need to sleep. That was the other thing. You know, I just didn't sleep. I just fed in the night, and then you know, Alice might be a bit windy and Nick was walking the corridors, and I wasn't sleeping when he was walking the corridors. I was just on my phone and doing things.
Were you being told to sleep, or did they just assume that you were?
They were saying, are you sleeping? And I remember just lying, because I felt like, oh, I think I'm probably a little bit different or special, like I don't need the sleep or something, you know. So I was like, oh yeah, yeah, I'm sleeping. So Nick didn't even know that I wasn't sleeping. It was almost like I was like, you know, I had this secret that no one knew.
That you were like superwoman. And
yeah, I'm like, didn't need it. Yeah. And you know, and I started, even when we left there after a few days and got home, I honestly was just like, this is a walk in the park. I am amazing at this. And you know, like that was that kind of day 4 or 5 was not needing sleep and thinking I was just the best mum on earth. And the best breastfeeder and the best everything, you know, like, and it was really starting to be sort of a almost like an ego thing, which again is part of the illness, but you know, just yeah, walk in the park. Yeah, I can do this easily. And Nick, you can go back to work because I'm fine. You know?
Yeah, we've got this.
So
at what point, you know, who first identified that there might be something else going on?
Yeah, so I mean, my mum was staying with us, and you know, we've had ups and downs in the past, and I started really arguing with her about a lot of things, and she, I remember her saying to me, like, sort of 6 days in, just like, I'm a bit worried about you. And I remember being like a teenager being like, how dare you, you know, rah, rah, rah. just really unkind. And Nick didn't realize I wasn't sleeping because I was still like secretly getting up, and I was like, I got to the point where I was like organizing the pantry at 3 a.m.
As you do.
Yeah. And hoping that Alice wouldn't wake up for a feed before I'd finished putting all the rice in the container. Like, you know, just, but again, it was a little bit secret. And I'd gone out the day before and got my hair done. And I remember sitting there talking to the hairdresser, and she was like, oh, how old's your baby? And I was like, oh, 5 days old. She was like, this is very odd. So it got to day 10, and I know that everyone was starting to be like, this is very unusual, but still not like outside potentially of my personality. And I rang my obstetrician, and I was at this point obsessed with my appearance. So I'd lost about 10 kilos again. This is part of the brain.
Yeah.
So I was like, I genuinely felt like I was stunning, like the most beautiful person. Like I could be a pushchair model type thing. And I rang my obstetrician, or she rang me for a quick checkup, and she could obviously hear my voice because it was very, very fast paced, which again is one of the, you know, symptoms. And I was telling her about, you know, she said to me, can you please be honest? Have you been sleeping? And I was like, well, no. And I said, well, last night was a good reason why I didn't sleep, because I've got the bushiest eyebrows you've ever seen, and I can't find my tweezers. So I was looking through the whole house, and I even looked in the dishwasher. Can you believe that? And I just remember her saying, I can believe that, Hannah, and I don't think you're very well, and I'm going to get somebody to give you a call to talk to you. And at that point, I was like, amazing. Someone's going to ring me. I wonder who they are. They might be someone really important. You know, like, it was, yeah.
So you weren't put out by her saying that then?
No, I was like, I think I must be quite special. That's what, yeah. So obviously I wasn't in a highly rational state of mind, but yeah, that was how I felt. So I remember getting off the phone, and again, I think he was at work at this point, maybe, saying, oh, apparently I'm not very well, but it's okay. Like, obviously I'm not really bad, but you know, someone's going to ring me later. So that's what they did. They rang, a person rang, and I was really excited to hear from them, and I was super excited because they were from the maternal mental health team, and I was like, that sounds really important. That sounds like only special people get called by them, you know, like, yeah. So
no warning bells in your mind about, hang on a minute.
I think I did know that there was something not right, but the feeling was so good, so you know, I was so high, I guess, that I just, it was almost like whatever it is that's going on is kind of a good thing. Well, no, I mean, not a good thing, but it's not concerning potentially. Like maybe they might have to give me a pill to make me feel less high. Like I think that was what it just didn't seem at the time that it was that big a deal. And so this person rang me and I couldn't work out, I remember not working out whether it was a man or a woman, and kind of being quite perplexed about this. And at the end of the phone call, I actually said, I can't tell if you're a man or a woman. What are you? Which I would never say to anyone. And it was a man. But he went through a whole heap of different sort of symptoms and questions and things. And at the end, he said, look, there's 10 signposts for a manic episode, and you need to get 7 of them or more to be classified as having a manic episode. And I was like, how many did I get? And he was like, 10. And I was like, I can't believe it. I got an A plus. Oh, and I remember saying, is it an A plus or is it an A plus plus? And he was just like, violent. Right, okay, bad question. So that was the diagnosis. So from that point, it was a Friday, and he said, look, we can't do anything until Monday. So you just kind of have to just try and be kind of calm down, which obviously was a bit, you know, can't do that. And the weekend came, and unfortunately we had my sister-in-law and her husband and their little girl, who was only 1 at the time, so this is my husband's sister, and they came to stay, which was a terrible idea, obviously, but at that point didn't really sort of realise how serious it was. So they came to stay, and we went shopping. That was the thing that we did together. We all went shopping, which, no good for someone having a manic episode, because I was literally rampaging around the mall trying to buy everything and being really irrational, and it all just got so terrible to the point that it got to that night, and I just, like, it was too much. I think that stimulation too of too many people, you know, you need to be like almost in a quiet room, and they had to call the acute adult psych team, and 5 people came in the door to kind of deal with me, which was just like, and that I was really scared then. Like I remember feeling really scared, like a kind of like that feeling that you get, and I don't know if you've been through that, which is like, you know, being young and drinking way too much and feeling a bit out of control and having a massive fight with your boyfriend and then being really confused about what actually happened. It was like that. It was like not understanding how it had got so bad. Yeah.
So what happened then when the psych team, did you feel you'd kind of overstepped a mark or?
Oh, I mean, I told Nick I wanted a divorce, and then I'd also tried to book flights to go to Fiji on my own. So there was like, I knew that it was really great. The 2 of them stayed with the family, kind of trying to talk to them about kind of what was happening. And then 2 of them came and we sat in Alice's room and I sat on the chair, and I just remember trying to like justify what had happened, you know, like Nick had done this and Beck had done this, and you know, and it was just, you know, and my sister-in-law had actually really shouted at me because I had been, you know, behaving so badly in front of her little girl, so her mothering instinct, and you know, I mean, it was all just so terrible. So they gave me some pills to take to calm me down, and kind of that was the, and then we actually got the team to come the next, well, they came the next morning, so it was just a really like huge kickoff, I suppose, which really made everyone realize that things were really, really serious. Yeah.
And so when did you get a diagnosis? Because you were diagnosed with a bipolar episode. Is it a one-off thing, yeah, or is it?
So it was, so at the time they kept saying it was a manic episode. So it took 6 weeks to get me from that state, and the whole time I was at home. And they gave me carers and, you know, mental health nurses all day and all night. So I had people there to look after me because I couldn't look after Alice. I was like completely couldn't focus on her, you know. And I remember Googling, and because I studied psychology, and I was like, kept Googling manic episode And all I could see was bipolar. And I was like, well, that's not what it is. I'm just having a manic episode. So I still, and they never said, they were just so focused on getting me out of this high that after the 6 weeks, and I was really quite back to normal, we went for a meeting at the awful, dilapidated sort of mental health unit and sat in front of the psych team and the psychiatrist. And she said, right, so I'm really happy that you are feeling better. I do need to let you know that you, because of this, like, you've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and you'll have this for the rest of your life. There's no cure for it. Unfortunately, childbirth triggered it, but this will be this. And, you know, in my mind, bipolar was so serious, you know, like it was like that's in the scary mental illness pile. You know, like, I can deal with it if you like, you're going to deal with depressive episodes for the rest of your life or something. But I'm like, I can't deal with bipolar. So that was awful. And then she said, unfortunately, what comes up must come down, and you can't have a manic episode in isolation. So you will have a depressive episode. And I'm really sorry, but you were so acutely manic that this depressive episode is going to be terrible. And it was like, what? You know, and I just said to her, I'm like, no, that's not going to happen, because I'm a really happy, positive person, and I don't think it's going to affect me, you know. And she said, I'm like, you know, I need to be honest with you, Unique, you know. So yeah, that was like the worst meeting of our lives.
Oh my god, yeah. I mean, just like, talk about a rug pull.
Oh, huge. And it was like, but we've been through this awful thing. I mean, to be fair, the manic episode wasn't anywhere near as awful for me as it was for my friends and family, because I was sort of, you know, you're high. But yeah, so it took 2 weeks before the depressive episode came. And I just couldn't believe it. It was literally going to sleep at night, feeling like myself, and opening my eyes and being like, it was like it didn't come slowly. It came like a wallop, you know. It was like, I can never get over that side of it, that it wasn't gradual and it was so extreme. It was, it was just a massive, massive shock. And then trying to explain it to Nick, like, I'm not okay. Like, I can't even describe to you how not okay I am. So that was it. That was like the next step of the journey, really.
And what support was offered to you to sort of help you cope with that low?
So we ended up, it was so bad that when I say bad, I'm not sort of saying I couldn't get out of bed, because I did, because I was so committed to fighting it and being there for Alice. So I always got out of bed, but it was like, it was so acute and it came with such high anxiety. So it was like this absolute helplessness, no color in the world, couldn't taste anything, you know, all that. But then it was also this absolute panic of, you might be like this for the rest of your life, you can't look after your baby, you know. So it was just this double sort of thing. And they gave me, again, I had carers through the day and night. So it was just like the manic episode, but they were different carers who could deal with this part. And it was more like sort of maternal, kind of like nannies, who, you know, and I like, for example, I had one woman who, she was this amazing Samoan lady who was literally almost filled our whole room, like, you know, metaphorically and physically. And she was so amazing. And she used to I just used to lie on her lap and she'd just stroke my hair with her fingers, you know. And it was like, and do you know, and I think about that, the fact that I was in this absolute terrible state and she did that. And then what I did is kind of learnt from her was I couldn't look after Alice and I couldn't do anything, but I did the same. I just would lie on the floor next to Alice and just put my hand on her, and that's all I did. But it was like that same thing, like, I'm here, you know, that's what I can do. And so, you know, like that was how it went. And unfortunately, as it turned out, I had this reaction to my medication, but it was called cyclical depression. So I had 2 weeks, sounds like a roster, 2 weeks really, really depressed, 10 days absolutely fine, 2 weeks horrendously depressed. And that happened 3 times until they realized that actually it was the medication. And then that kind of got on top of it. But I knew to the day when I was going to be well or depressed. And the wow. on day 10 of being well, I literally would say goodbye to everyone, you know, and then it would be back. And it's just the fact it can be so, you know, like, I can't even describe kind of how sort of like to the day it was.
Were you able to do much for Alice at the time, or was it just, as you say, that golden touch of just being present with her?
Yeah, I like I could, so I wasn't breastfeeding at this point, obviously. So like I would give her a bottle, but I would get sort of halfway through the bottle and just be so overwhelmed with anxiety. And, you know, and I had this sort of fear that I was passing these vibes to her, like my distress was going to make her distressed. So I would always seek to give her to someone to feed her. I would almost come up with like a reason, like, I need to go to the bathroom. Can you just give her bottle? You know, because then I would be like, she's getting love. So I really couldn't do a lot at all. It was actually just surviving. Like it was, and I'd look back on it and I'm like, it was minute by minute. It wasn't even hour by hour. It was just like, what am I going to do with this next minute? And maybe sometimes I could give her a cuddle or something, but then sometimes it was just, you know, I've got to just get through. So yeah, it seemed like a lifetime of it, which obviously it wasn't, but
for you going through it at that time.
Yeah.
So when did things start to turn a corner for you?
So it would have been as soon as they sort of realized that this cyclical situation was happening. I'd been going to actually a support group for other women with sort of mental health issues or maternal mental health issues. And I even doing that was each cycle of depression got easier. So the second one I was like, okay, I've survived, and what worked last time? And so by the third time I didn't need a carer. So even then it was almost like, okay, well, if I have another cycle, I might be like even better. So that was helpful. But then once we got on top of it, I lived with sort of about a year of pretty bad anxiety, especially around sleep and things. But I kind of felt like maybe that was kind of like a normal level, like a lot of my friends and a lot of other women go through that. So that bit was a little bit easier. And then it wasn't until sort of a year later that we decided to move down to Christchurch and kind of start fresh and, you know, get away from it felt like demons, you know.
Yeah.
And I went back to work. That point, it was like, okay, I've survived. Like I really have survived, and my brain can function at work, and I can live on this medication that I'm on. And that was like, Christchurch was sort of this, sort of savior, really.
If you enjoy this episode of Blue Mum Days, please rate and subscribe. It only takes a minute, but it genuinely makes a difference to how many people can find it, which means helping more parents in need. Thank you.